Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sangoma, Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation. I'm your host, Batabi Levin-Tombini, and I am so pleased to be in the offices of the New York Peace Institute with Brad Heckman, the New York Peace Institute CEO. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Batabi. Great to be here.
Yes, awesome. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. You know, we've chatted a little bit about your story, and there's just so much in there that's really rich and interesting, and I'm fascinating to me. So I'm really glad that we have this chance to chat about your journey into mediation and the New York Peace Institute. I like to start with people's stories, of course, going into their background and what led them to become mediators. I'm interested, of course, in what makes people tick and why they choose mediation. But before we get into that, I want to make sure that people who are listening can actually hear us. So what I'm doing is I'm launching a chat room, and I need your help if you're listening and you're listening online on your computer. I'm going to launch a chat room. Please sign in to the show so that you can see the chat room and let me know if you can hear us. I'm connecting to the show a little bit differently than I usually do. We're using a speakerphone, and I'm hoping that it's an improvement over Skype because Skype can sometimes be a little iffy. But if you can log into the chat room and let us know if you can hear us, you may hear me typing there, so that we can be sure that the show is going out in a manner that, you know, is actually conducive to people listening. So, Brad, you grew up in Pennsylvania in a small town, is it?
I did. I grew up in Catasauqua, Pennsylvania.
I'm wondering how to pronounce that.
Catasauqua.
Okay.
And it's a suburb of Allentown,
which
you may have heard of from
I've
the Billy Joel song.
Yes.
So, blue-collar, working-class, steel town, and
that's
where I grew up.
What was it like?
What was it like? Oh, that's a great question. When I was growing up, it was at the time that the steel mills were closing, so it was really transitioning from being an industrial town to a different kind of place, one governed by the service sector, so by the big box type stores. But it was an interesting mix because it was both industrial but also Pennsylvania Dutch farm country. And my family reflected that. So I had one grandfather who was a steel worker in the steel mills and another who was a Pennsylvania Dutch farmer. And growing up, I have to say it was a very athletic, sports-oriented town, and I may well be your most unathletic guest ever. I really, really mean that. So growing up, I was the artsy, nerdy, bookish kind of kid.
How does that fly in a town where, you know, it's steel workers or farmers, so you, like you said, you know, really physical and that sort of thing? I mean, where does a kid in that situation find their niche?
Well, I had very, very supportive parents, both of whom inadvertently really inspired me to do public service work. So my mom was a nurse and my father was a school teacher for many years. And, yeah, they were really supportive of me being a little bit of an oddball. And I really believe that you'll find your niche everywhere. So mine was the band. I was a band geek.
What did you play?
At that time, I played the trumpet and the piano.
Ah, so is it a marching band or was it like a symphonic band where you get to sit down and play?
I played both sitting and standing.
Okay.
So there was the marching band, and of course we played at all the football games.
Yes.
And so I must have been to dozens of football games, and I still don't understand the sport. It confuses me. I may focus on the uniforms being cool colors,
sure.
But that's about as far as I can go on that. So when I was in the jazz band and symphonic band and all those different things.
Yeah.
And then I hadn't been musical for some time, and then around 10 years ago I decided to learn how to play the accordion.
Oh, great. Awesome.
My dad
actually played the accordion, and I don't know if if he's listening. It would be interesting if he decides to pick it up again, but I remember as a really little kid in South Africa that my dad played the accordion, so I have special memories of the accordion. So you picked up the accordion.
I did, and that's well, this is fast-forwarding quite a bit, but I did a lot of work in the Roma, or commonly known as gypsy community. cities in Eastern and Central Europe,
yeah.
And I was fascinated by their music,
yeah.
and a lot of it is accordion-driven,
sure.
So I thought I'd learn how to play.
Right.
And this may be surprising, but neighbors in New York City are not big fans of the accordion, which
really?
I...
Really? You don't say.
I know, go figure, right?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we could talk about how that might... and gender opportunities to use your mediation skills in a little bit. But, yeah, so it's nice if you're coming back to your musical roots, and in your roots you had, you know, trumpet, you're playing piano and so forth, and I'm assuming you were or guessing you were involved in other artistic endeavors and so forth. And so when that is your bent, you're heading for college, where a lot of your classmates college-bound?
Many of them were. Others went into the military or got local jobs. I think I grew up in the kind of place where people really stayed put, and they raised their kids and then subsequent generations there as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I took a little bit of a different path and moved to New York and lived in some other places,
yeah.
as well.
Moved out to the big city.
I moved to the big city, right, thinking that I could survive here for maybe a year or so. It's been going on 20 years now that I've been here.
Really awesome. When you got to college, what caught your eye? What did you decide you wanted to do?
At that point I had no idea, really. I certainly hadn't heard of mediation at that point. But I was very active in social justice type issues. Like the anti-apartheid movement at my college,
right.
and different activities like that. So
mm-hmm.
I actually went to a politically really conservative school.
Mm-hmm.
So this was during the Reagan administration,
mm-hmm.
and if I were to guess, I'd say the majority of the students were conservative Republicans, and I was kind of a student activist type. And that was, of course, before I knew about mediation and different pathways to promoting social justice. But I think my involvement in the mediation field really stemmed from a belief in social justice and a desire to find modalities to pursue that.
Well, what did you major in?
I majored in political science.
Well,
with
speaking of modalities to pursue that,
right? Right, political science with a minor in Italian studies.
Okay, all right. And so you have your activism going on, you're majoring in political science, and at some point you end up in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've told me is that you finagled your way into Poland, so you've got my curiosity really piqued by that. What do you mean by that?
I know. I so regret using the word finagled now. I feel I owe you some kind of a lascivious story around that. But, what it was, at that point, I was a political science student,
yeah.
And I was also fascinated by labor movement, my grandfather being a union member in the steel mill and so on. And Poland had, in the early 1980s, gone through a tremendous upheaval that was generated largely from the Solidarity labor movement, which became a mass protest against the Soviet regime.
Mm-hmm.
In the mid to late 80s, there was the Perestroika and Glasnost movement in the former Soviet Union, in which things were starting to open up, and the Solidarity movement was re-legalized in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it interesting, and I really had no idea what to do with my life. So I had a friend who was from Poland and helped me get a job teaching English at a university there, which at that time wasn't really easy. There weren't a whole lot of Americans behind the Iron Curtain at that
point. This is the thing that comes to mind, because, of course, I remember that time, although, you know, I was, like, really wee at the time. Yeah, I was two.
Right.
Very precocious.
Right. Audience, just so you know, Batavia was winking at that moment.
Yes. And, but, you know, I remember that there was a lot of tension, if that's the word to use, or, you know, around going to Eastern Europe, and
mm-hmm.
in many ways, I guess, you know, for a person who doesn't remember that time, it might be like going to Cuba is today. You know, there's that kind of,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Russia was the grand enemy, and, you know, so going to communism, you know, it was this really big thing. And here you're deciding, you know, to go ahead and take this job over there. When you are planning, you know, to go on this trip, and I guess you have to get your visas and that sort of thing, what kind of reactions are you getting from officials, from friends, teachers, that kind of thing?
I think from friends and teachers, they were encouraging. My family was concerned. My grandmother came from Eastern Europe, and the few memories she had of the place were kind of bad. So it was met with consternation. Plus, I was pretty aimless career-wise at that point. So, you know, my family was rightfully concerned. And it was considered a scary place.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, and it's hard to imagine today because you go to a city like Prague, and I think it's one of the top 10 tourist destinations in the world, and it was a ghost town back then, a little hidden treasure in the in Europe. And I remember one of the things I had to do was come and meet with the Polish consulates here in New York and convince them that I wasn't a spy. And I had what felt to me as, you know, as a 22-year-old kid, like an interrogation, in which these two men were asking me all these questions, you know, basically around, am I going to be propagandizing for the United States, am I in the CIA, all of these kinds of questions. And then afterwards, one of them pulled me aside, and he's like, dude, really, why are you going there? We couldn't wait to get out of that place. It was a very different place. And I got there, and it was an incredible experience. And I was just really lucky to be there at a time of just an incredible transition.
Yeah.
That I certainly couldn't have
predicted. What was your sense of the place when you arrived?
Mm-hmm. It was a paradoxical place. Because, you know, here I am seeing these absolute beautiful buildings, meeting people out were just wonderful and hospitable and friendly. And at the same time, there were shortages. So all the things that you may remember from movies from the 80s about people waiting in red lines and things like that, that was true. But it changed almost overnight. So as I was there, within a few months, elections were held. There was a peaceful transition to a democratic government and a shared power arrangement. And suddenly shops were popping up everywhere. Fast food was introduced. The borders were opened. So I really feel like that kind of, you know, vintage Soviet version of Poland was something that I really saw the last gasp of that.
And right, and things, right in the end of it, yeah.
Yeah, things changed really, really overnight.
You know, in the field that we work in ADR, dispute resolution, mediation, and so forth, we understand that often the greatest strife that people experience comes around change.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, great moments of social change can also bring about a lot of stress and a lot of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're describing a situation where it seemed like it was almost, you know, just, what was that?
You know, it's, in a way it was really seamless because that part of the world is no stranger to change.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very possible to even now, to live your life in four different countries without leaving your village. So there were so many transitions from the Soviet Union to independence to the Nazi regime under World War II. So these are populations that are incredibly resilient. They know how to deal with shortages. They know how to deal with change. It was really, really remarkable. At the same time, there was something really celebratory about what was happening. But it was a mix. So people suddenly had freedoms that they had only dreamt of before, but they were also dealing with the economic realities of capitalism and losing social safety nets and all kinds of things like that. And one of the things that really struck me was I went there really pretending to be an English teacher. I was
that's the finagle part, isn't it?
Yes, finagle might be the right word. I thought since I had been a language student, I could probably be an English teacher. And,
sure, you speak the language.
And I was somehow under the impression that my students would be conversant in English, but they weren't. For many of them, they had never met an American or a native speaker before, and whereas they knew grammar quite well, which I didn't, and I still don't. They weren't really able to converse.
Yeah.
So, I was kind of like a low-rent version of Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society, in which I tried to make it as much about the experience of learning as,
sure.
you know, as the material itself.
Yeah.
But I had anticipated being given some kind of a curriculum that I would use to teach, you know, a textbook or something like that. And I was. And the textbook that I was given was all about Lenin and communism and being a loyal party member and all this kind of stuff, which didn't even resonate under communism with the students, and now that things were changing. So I really had to create a whole new way of learning and curriculum. And I learned a lot of things that I do to this day, using a lot of interactive exercises and visual arts and role plays and things like that. So that in itself was a real good primer for what I do today.
Right, yeah. And, of course, we're going to be talking about how your experiences in Eastern Europe have informed the path you've taken coming back and now finally being at the New York Peace Institute. I am curious to know, though, where were you when the wall actually came down?
I was at a dinner party at a fellow instructor's house. We were all having dinner and we were watching it on TV, and it was just it was really incredible. And so we saw David Hasselhoff singing on the top of the wall, and
we in the United States don't get that. We don't understand the Hasselhoff.
The Hasselhoff effect?
Yeah.
Right.
Of all the people who's going to be there, and, you know, David Hasselhoff, but that's cool.
And he was huge in Germany, and I remember he was wearing this suit that, if I remember correctly, had like little light bulbs, and it was glowing, and it was just incredible. But at that moment, that was, it was really emblematic of what was this mixture of tremendous social change and freedom and also an injection of Western kitsch,
mm-hmm.
which was one of the first things that people gravitated towards.
Right,
there. And,
right.
And
so you mentioned McDonald's and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And I imagine there was great curiosity then about the rest of the world that had been shut out for so long, and you know, people being very eager to experience and absorb all of that.
Oh, for sure. And you know, for years there was definitely a thriving underground.
Mm-hmm.
But my students, many of them grew up not having things like jeans or having to, you know, there was a tremendous black market
mm-hmm.
music trade.
Mm-hmm.
So people, as I said, they're a resilient population, so they found ways to get the information that they needed.
Right. Now, you say that your introduction to the possibilities and the potentials of, let's say, ADR and mediation and so forth really is informed by your time there and watching this process take place. Tell me a bit more about that.
Sure. Well, you know, I went there as a student activist type, enjoying the romanticism of holding signs and protesting and doing all
right.
that great, great, great stuff. And then I saw a change in power that was the result of a negotiated roundtable discussion that brought former enemies and combatants in all sectors of society together. And it really profoundly impacted me, not in a way that I thought I'd be able to make a career out of it, but I really found it fascinating. And then I had remembered that an uncle of mine from Pennsylvania, where I grew up, who was a social worker, was a community mediator years and years ago, and he had told me about it, and that kind of struck me. So these ideas were kind of swimming around in my head, that it is possible to use civil disobedience and activism as a springboard to bring about social change. So what I had, you know, what I had learned as a student activist type was how to bang on the door.
Mm-hmm.
What I saw in Poland is what happens when someone lets you in the room.
Oh, wow.
And it was just fascinating. And it was some years later that, you know, that I actually became involved in the ADR field. But that, I think, that was definitely the tipping point for
right.
me.
Right, yeah. And it sounds like it's something that you refer back to in what you do now, you know, that experience, and at least, you know, giving a sense of hope. The things that we work on here are not, generally speaking, on the level of regime change,
right?
And so I'm thinking that if you can see it working in on that level,
mm-hmm.
Then of course, you know, it gives better, more faith to the idea of it working on the level, on the ground level, the grassroots level that you work at here in New York.
Yeah, absolutely, and the reverse is true as well. You know, I do occasional work with the UN and did a lot of this work internationally, and on occasion we train UN diplomats, and often we take them through our basic mediation training in Brooklyn, New York style, and typically the first response is, well, this is really just too basic for us, and but soon, very often, they realize, wow, these same core principles that we learn in mediation training are applicable in the field of international diplomacy. In fact, Doug Knoll's book, Elusive Peace, really focuses on how the diplomatic corps would do well to learn what we learn in community mediation.
Certainly. Absolutely. So, speaking of community mediation, you come back to the United States, and eventually, well, how did that happen that you got into mediation?
Well, I got into it because I went to grad school, studied international relations, and a gentleman named Raymond Schoenholtz, who was really one of the pioneers of community mediation here in the States and established arguably the first community mediation center in San Francisco, Community Boards, back in the 70s, he had this idea of setting up community mediation centers in the new democracies of Eastern and Central Europe and the former Soviet Union.
So taking the model from San Francisco and applying it in that context.
Yeah, seeing if it would work, because these were countries whose judicial systems were either nascent or perceived to be corrupted or non-existent. So the idea was, you know, what if ADR were built within the rule of law framework from the outset?
Fantastic.
And while people were figuring out how to resolve their disputes officially, if there was some mechanism to deal with all the tensions and conflicts that normally happen in society, but were also bubbling up because of reduced social safety nets and increasing ethnic tensions and so on and so forth. And Ray hired a gentleman named Jim Eisenberg, who is currently on my board, who was looking for someone who had experience in that part of the world and had at least a vague interest in peace building. So he hired me to really help set up local mediation centers in that part of the world back in the mid-90s. So that's really how I got my start specifically in the mediation field, by essentially setting up what I guess I could call prototypes of New York peace institutes in Europe and the Balkans and South Caucasus and former Soviet Union.
Now, how were they received?
Oh, it was so interesting. You know, the typically the first response was, you know, this whole mediation thing is it's a really touchy-feely California idea. It's never going to work in our context, which is often the reaction of people who go through our training here. So there was this impression that in the United States, people automatically go to mediation.
Oh, dear.
Right?
Never been to New York City.
I know. Well, there was this kind of paradoxical view of Americans that on the one hand, we mediate everything, and
sure,
we're touchy-feely, and we also carry guns.
Oh.
And you know what? Both of those realities exist
in
our country, so
sure,
they were right to kind of grasp that paradox.
Right.
But I remember, you know, we took the first generation of fledgling Eastern European mediators and took them to San Diego, California, where there was a very vibrant mediation center, and took them through a basic mediation training.
Yeah.
And they were quite intrigued, but also, you know, understandably skeptical, because they didn't see it in action, and they were seeing it in the, you know, beautiful environment. You know, there's palm trees and things like that in
San
Diego. San
Diego's gorgeous.
It is gorgeous.
San Diego
is
almost unnaturally gorgeous.
Yes. You sound vaguely suspicious when you say that.
Seriously, I mean, you know, I grew up in Southern California. So,
oh, you did.
You know, but in more desert, you know, about 80 miles northeast of Los Angeles, it's very hot, very dry.
Oh.
So when we go to places like San Diego, we scoff, because we're like, oh, you know, this is, you know, pampered stuff.
Yes, there was much scoffing as well when I was there with the group. And in fact, I remember one of the things that we went through a whole training, not just to become mediators, but also to learn how to operate a mediation center, so how to do case management, client engagement skills, statistical analysis, all of these kinds of things. And I remember someone on staff saying, you know, we put fresh cookies out every morning in our waiting area for our clients, and even when and they're gone after a few minutes, but the smell of the freshly baked chocolate chip cookies continues to waft through the center, and you know, triggers people's pleasure centers in their brains and so on. And yeah, my colleagues who were emerging from the dark days of communism were thinking this will never work. So
chocolate chip cookies.
Right. What is this chocolate chip cookie?
Yeah.
Put some pierogies out there. Maybe we can do business. But fast forward a couple of years, we decided that you know at this point let's not bring the Eastern Europeans to learn mediation here in the States. Let's have people from the region training each other. So by that time, I believe it was the Hungarians and the Czechs had a couple of years under their belt. So the next generation of mediators from neighboring countries came in, and they were trained by a Czech and Hungarian team. And I was at that training, and they said, well, all right, well, we learned mediation, you know, in this touchy-feely Southern California kind of way. We're going to teach it to you how it works in our culture. And it's very different, and no offense to Brad. I mean, I was in the room here, but this is a very different kind of mediation than we learned. And I was intrigued and kind of horrified, you know, like, what's this actually going to look like?
Yeah.
And it was, I would say it was like 90% the same as the model that they had learned. And it really spoke to a certain universality of some
yeah.
of the values and principles of mediation. But the fact that they owned it as their way of doing it, and there were certain things that were changed a little bit.
What kinds of things?
You know, almost cosmetic things. Like many of the countries I worked in had, the culture is a bit more formal. So like in French, there's the tu and vous form. They
uh-huh.
have their own linguistic version of that. So in our opening statement, we might ask clients, you know, how would you like to be addressed? Mm-hmm. Well, in their context, you would never ask that. It's you
but
know,
you
would,
do you know?
Yes, yeah, so you would always call someone Mr. or Ms.
Mm-hmm.
to start with. So that would so that question would be a non-starter. So things like that. A bit more of a formality on that front, but otherwise it was largely the same. Actually, one thing that really impressed me was that the centers that I helped to develop very quickly moved from the kind of standard two-party mediation that we do here into highly complex multi-party community-wide disputes.
They did this on their own?
They really did. I mean, our goal was to provide them with some of the training, the resources, helping them with things like organizational structure and strategic planning and things like that. But we made it really clear that this was your center that's meant to reflect your culture, the local issues that you see as appropriate to work with. So we were there to be kind of cheerleaders and an engine, but it was their locomotive.
Mm-hmm.
So they immediately started jumping into these highly complex issues that were astounding, and this was at a time when everything about that part of the world was changing, the way local government worked, the way citizen participation looked. So it was like a laboratory, it was an experiment in which to really apply these principles of ADR to a living stage.
Awesome! Wow. What has come of it now? What are you still in touch? Are you able to go back?
I am. You know, I haven't been back as frequently as I would like. Just a couple of years ago, we had a 20-year reunion of the founding of the organization. And I was there last. I was in Washington D.C. last year. Sadly, because Ray Schoenholtz, the founder, passed away far
mm-hmm.
too young, but. Many of my colleagues who I worked with years ago were there, and they're all doing incredible things. So these, you know, these fledgling little community mediation centers are thriving 15, 20 years later.
That's awesome to hear.
Yeah, I couldn't be prouder to have been associated with them.
Yeah, wow. So it looks like you've taken that experience that you had establishing the mediation centers in Eastern Europe, and now you are here in New York, and...
Mm-hmm.
I take it you've been involved with what is now the New York Peace Institute for a while it was still Safe Horizons.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about that. How did that relationship start?
Oh, sure. Well, at a certain point, towards the end of my work, my international work, I really felt this longing to come home and serve my own community. And by that time, I considered myself a New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And
for the 10 years. You know the 10-year rule.
Yeah, it's the 10-year or half your life. I've heard.
Is it half your life?
I've heard that one.
Oh boy.
yeah, you know. But at the same, a great thing about New York is, you know, you can be a New Yorker the day that you arrive here.
Yes.
You know,
it's about an attitude. It's about a way of thinking about the world and life here in the city.
Yeah, sure. And there's part of it that will always be the Rube from a small town in Pennsylvania. But I just felt I wanted to really serve my community and not be constantly flying in and out of places and building something. I really wanted to be part of something that I would be able to contribute to on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt this need to come home. Also, I have family illness issues, and I wanted to be home and attend to them as well. And the only job that I really wanted was to run the Safe Horizon Mediation Program, which had at that time been one of the largest mediation centers in the country, and I had known about since the mid-90s, because when I would bring Central and Eastern Europeans to the United States for things like study tours, they would come here to observe cases.
Hmm.
So I was somewhat familiar with the program back then.
Just to provide context for folks who are not familiar with Safe Horizons, what was that and is actually still? I mean, you know, we can talk about the transition, but what was Safe Horizons all about?
Sure. Safe Horizon is a large victim services agency. So it's a big organization in New York City. I think it has something like 50 locations throughout the city. It runs domestic violence shelters. It has a crime victims hotline. It does wonderful work around child abuse. It helps victims of sexual assault. But primarily helping people transition from being victims into survivors. And the mediation, and it's been around for, I want to say, about 35 years. It started as a small startup spinoff from the Vera Institute back in the 70s and is now an organization that's, I think, something like 700 people strong, doing just really amazing work. The mediation program was one piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
Helping prevent violence by having some mechanism through which people could peacefully and creatively resolve their disputes. And that's when I came to know the organization. Now, actually, Safe Horizon was at that time called Victim Services. So it's gone through a few name and branding changes. So that's a little bit of the context. So we were a little part of it. So paradoxically, the Safe Horizon Mediation Program was probably one of the largest mediation centers in the country, but only a very small part of this larger violence prevention agency. And I really wanted to work for the program. And by sheer luck, as I was looking for a job here in the city, the senior director of the program was leading the organization, and I was really, really lucky to get the job as a senior director of the mediation.
You call it luck. I think you had a little bit of experience under your belt that might have contributed to that.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say so. But actually, if I can get a little bit schmaltzy or Malden for a second, I remember, you know, this was happening when my father was terminally ill, and that's one of the reasons that I came back from working internationally. And I remember telling him, Dad, I really, really want this job. I really wanted to promote mediation in New York, and that's how I want to help people. That's how I want to serve. But at the same time, I'm here to take care of you, because he was really sick.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, look, you don't apply for that job and try your best, I am going to haunt you after I pass away. So you
that's
better
great.
Go for it, right? Right? So how's that?
You can't argue with that.
I know. It's like he really kind of gave me that, like, that encouragement with his fabulous wit.
Yeah,
that really made a difference. So that's that helped me along, as well as the luck or whatever I brought to the table.
Yeah, powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of pulled you into that, taking that opportunity and taking the step to apply and get in. So how long have you been with what's now New York Peace Institute, but then Safe Horizons?
You know, I think it's going on 8 years.
Yeah.
So I started here, and then I a few years into it, I got another job at Safe Horizon, where I was overseeing the mediation program as well as some other fabulous programs, including the anti-human trafficking program, the men's batterers program, families of homicide victims program, and legal services. So I had a portfolio of various different programs, and it was great because I learned so much about about realms of work beyond the ADR field. And then about 2 years ago, Safe Horizon went through a strategic planning process that I was fortunate to be part of, in which it asked itself some real existential questions around what is and what should our core mission be. And the thought was that mediation is a great program, but it's not quite a mission fit with our core area of work, which
well,
is really
what was the issue? I'm sorry, but I'm curious about where perhaps tension came in or a perception that there was a misalignment, would we call it that?
It was really a dialogue in which, as a group, we sat down and looked at, like, what are the areas of work that really drive Safe Horizon's mission? And those really were domestic violence, human trafficking, child abuse, sexual abuse, youth at risk. And what about mediation and a few other programs? And we had a lot of really vibrant discussions, and we looked at mediation as not only not being a great fit for those areas of work. I mean, certainly it's a violence prevention mechanism, but also we felt that as an agency we weren't really doing our client the best service, because to find the Safe Horizon mediation program, you really had to go through a lot of information on the website around domestic violence and things like that. So we weren't really able to reach out to the people who needed our services in a way that we felt we could. So both the agency and I felt that there must be a way that we can honor the history of this program and continue to serve people in a way that would benefit from this historical relationship, but would also allow us the freedom and flexibility that we didn't have being part of a larger organization whose primary mission was not ADR.
So then there came a decision, you know, that as a person who values relationship and, you know, ADR, bleeding heart liberal kind of sort of thing, that kind of a split in my imagination can be really challenging. How did it play out?
It was a real opportunity to model the core values that we believe in. So it was terrifying, right? Because here I am, you know, trying to launch the organization, work on everything from building a budget to a board of directors to an organizational structure, and really hold the anxieties that we as a team were feeling. But it was great, and to this day and moving forward, we have a great relationship with Safe Horizon. Their general counsel is on our board of directors. We have regular meetings, so we met even after we became independent on a regular basis to kind of work out our systems, be they fiscal systems, human resource policies, and I have to say my colleagues at Safe Horizon have just been extraordinary, and so it was like it's funny because I worked in parts of the world where I've seen countries fragment into much smaller countries, and sometimes it happened disturbingly and violently, as in the former Yugoslavia, and other times it happened quite peacefully and amicably, as in Czechoslovakia, and they had what they called the velvet divorce between the Czech Republic and Slovakia. So I would say this was kind of a velvet divorce, as these things go. And I wouldn't call it a divorce. I think we really took it to a different kind of level.
Right,
so
yeah. They've transitioned into a different relationship, but a relationship still that serves the interests of the organizations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, yeah. It's fantastic. You know, I'm curious, you were talking about building systems and budgets and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
How is the New York Peace Institute funded? You know, is it a government institution, a quasi-governmental institution? What's the nature of the business?
Great question. So we're a nonprofit organization, so an independent 501c3 nonprofit organization. That just means we're tax-exempt.
Mm-hmm.
We are largely funded by the unified court system of the state of New York. And one area in which New York State is really progressive is that there is a statute, Article 21A, which mandates that every county in New York has a place to go to for mediation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and we're lucky to have that service in Brooklyn and Manhattan, funded in part by the unified court system and also by the criminal justice coordinator of the Office of the Mayor. And then, like any nonprofit organization, part of my job is fundraising and raising resources through grants and donations and services and,
right.
and so on.
Right. So how then do people find you?
Great question. You know, one of my real mandates is to really try to get the word out, to make us as visible as possible.
People, but you're here today.
And we're here, you know, and one way people find us is through our website.
Yeah.
So if you go to nypeace.org.
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 Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have very simple referral forms, so a lot of clients will find us online.
Mm-hmm.
We're listed on 311, so if you call 311, if you have a beef with your neighbor around noise or any New York kind of a thing, you call 311, there's a high chance they'll refer you to New York Peace Institute.
That is awesome. That is fantastic. So the operators there are trained to think of mediation as something to suggest to people who call in with these complaints?
Yeah, we're a referral there, so we get a lot
That's
of
really
cases
great.
Through there.
Yeah.
And one of our goals is to really be woven into the fabric of social service agencies, community-based organizations, government organizations. So we have great relationships with Human Resources Administration, with New York City Housing Authority, and faith-based organizations, and all kinds of groups where, you know, we're there as an absolutely free go-to resource for people who are involved in conflict.
Are you able to find out from people what motivates them to pick up the phone and try mediation, or, you know, when it's suggested, actually follow through on the suggestion?
That's a great question, and I learned so much in building or transitioning to New York Peace Institute. You know, you'll notice if you look at our materials, you're not going to find peace signs or doves or some of these kinds of tried and true symbols of mediation or of peace building. When people come to us, they're mad, they're
yeah.
angry, they want their money, they want their stuff, they want to confront the other person. So what we really learned here is to meet clients where they're at, is not to so overtly talk about peace or the kumbaya moment or the handshaking or all that, and all of those great things might happen,
mm-hmm.
but it's really honoring people's right to be in conflict,
mm-hmm.
and honoring conflict, cliche as it may sound, as an opportunity to generate some positive outcome or greater understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So very often people will come to us really mad and say, I don't want to mediate. I want to tell that person what I think. I want to look them in the eye and tell them how angry I am. And we'll say, well, we may be able to provide that opportunity for you.
I'm really interested in hearing that, because in my own work, you know, building a practice and bringing mediation to folks and suggesting it, and the conversations that I have with people who are not really familiar with mediation, that I have found that to be a particular challenge, to get across to them that mediation is not sitting around the campfire holding hands and singing,
mm-hmm.
you know, sweet songs,
mm-hmm.
that it is an opportunity to very energetically engage in a dialogue and a process that provides an opportunity for resolution if they decide to take it. So I'm really, again, interested in how it is that a person can come to you and say, you know, I mean, this is a mediation institute, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they'll come to you and say, I don't want to mediate, but they're there.
Right.
So how did they get in the door saying, I don't want to mediate?
So a couple of things. Our staff are just fabulous in really working with clients and applying all of the very skills that we teach in terms of listening to them and reflecting back what they're saying and understanding what their needs are and really giving the message of what can happen in mediation in a way that's really going to resonate. So I think, you know, hats off to our frontline staff who they deal with people in crisis and conflict every single day. It's really amazing. And then the other heroes in my mind are really our clients. I think it takes so much courage to sit down with your adversary, to sit down with an absolute complete stranger and talk about things that are deeply personal, that impact you emotionally in so many ways. So, I don't know that I have the answer as to why they come, but they do, and I think our clients are heroic for doing that and for sharing, you know, that slice of their lives with us.
Do you get feedback from them about the process afterwards?
We do, and that's so important to us. So we ask all of our clients who come in to fill out a very, very short form, and if they need help reading it or need it read to them, we'll do that. And we ask them questions about how did the process go, how did it work, did you feel heard, did you feel like you had an opportunity to be understood, did you understand the other person's point of view better. So we ask for that feedback, and then we call a lot of our clients. So we will randomly call clients and just check in with them and say, well, how are you doing? How did it work? How was the experience? Was there anything that we could have done differently or better to help out? And so we do that, and I just can't tell you how that important it is for us to both learn to be better at our jobs, but also to realize that sometimes we don't even know the impact of the work that we do here. And one short story, if I may, about that is
the show is all about stories.
we had a staff member who a while back mediated a case and just felt devastated afterwards. She actually felt that she had helped escalate the conflict, like it was a kind of anti-mediation, because in her mind the clients were more agitated when they left than when they came in, and really had some doubts about, oh my goodness, did I do the right thing? The very next day, one of the clients called, asked to speak with her, just to thank her profusely, and said, because of sitting down with us and because of what you showed and what you modeled, we were able to go home and resolve things on our own in a way that we never would have had we not come here. So honestly, those calls are great, not only from the quality assurance perspective, but just to really give us a little glimmer on the impact that we can have on people's lives in that short period of time that we spend with them here.
You know, that you've touched on something that I find deeply fascinating about mediation. And, you know, it's things that happen as sort of a split second. It's tough to capture it in that moment. But I've been there as a mediator. I know you've been there as a mediator, where you're sitting there going, man, am I messing this up? This is not going well. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, it's like, boom, something happens. And, you know, it's out of your hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening between the people in front of you. And I literally sometimes will just sort of sit back And let it be and let it happen, but have no idea how it happened.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And time is somehow condensed in mediation.
Yes.
That you look at animosities that may have festered for months,
years,
or years, or
yeah,
even generations.
Yeah.
In the space of a couple of hours, there can be enhanced understanding or even agreement. And,
right,
you know, I've studied this stuff, I've done this stuff, I teach this stuff. And likewise, there's something that's still kind of magical about it.
Yeah.
that I don't fully understand, and yet it works.
Right, yeah. The first mediation I ever saw was actually here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So I have, you know, a bit of nostalgia. As I was walking into the office, it all came back and I remembered it. And it was one of those moments. It was a mediation between people who were not native English speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And they came from West Africa, so they spoke French, but they spoke French as a second language even.
Uh-huh.
And they did share a language in common. In order to, I guess, broaden the conversation, they brought in a French translator and were attempting to do the mediation in French. And I remember the two women, and they were sitting across the table from each other talking about the altercation that had led them to be at the table. And then all of a sudden, as the mediator was doing, I don't remember exactly who the mediator was, if it was he or she, but as the mediator was doing his or her work, and the translator is going, all of a sudden they switch to the language that they had in common. So we're all sitting there in the room going, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them stood up and walked around the table. And as she's so dramatic, she gets up and she starts walking around the table. You know, you can see the hands sort of clenched on the seats. Everybody who's watching going, what is happening here? And the other woman stood up and they started bawling. They hugged each other.
Wow.
They were weeping and wailing. And we're all sitting there going, oh, this is awesome. What happened? So I remember that as my first introduction, and that's what really hooked me into mediation. And I'm glad to hear you saying this, because sometimes when I tell folks about this magical aspect of mediation, you know, they look at me as though I've got horns growing out of my head or something. So see, Brad said it.
Right. And for the record, listeners, Batavia does not have horns growing out of her.
No.
Right.
So, it is this wonderful, magical thing, and it's what keeps me hooked in. I get the sense it's what keeps you hooked in, and having the opportunity to share that with more people is such a wonderful thing. What is the future that you envision for the New York Peace Institute?
This for me, not just for New York Peace Institute, but for our field, I think this is the most exciting time that I've experienced so far, because I think we're at a point in our history in which we're an old and young movement at the same time. So community mediation has really only been around since the 70s. Mm-hmm. So we're awfully young, but we now have venerable elders in the field who are still around and are still leading the field. And at the same time, the new generation of peer mediators and millennials are coming of age and are also informing the process. So we have this great nexus of history and venerable experience with all kinds of new energy and creativity. And organizations like NASCM, the National Association for Community Mediation, and others are really, really leading the way and galvanizing the field. And I'm just delighted that New York Peace Institute is a small part of that. You know, there are TV shows about mediation.
Yes.
Now. There are films like The Interrupters, which is around a variation of what we do. So we're in the public consciousness in a way that I don't think that we've been before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really exciting. When I got into this field, there were precious few places to actually formally study mediation at the graduate level. Now they're all over the place.
Right. I did it in law school.
Myself, there you go.
Yeah.
Mediation clinics. So I think it really is our time to shine as a field. And so I'm delighted to be riding that crest here at New York Peace Institute. Also, I'm just delighted that that we really got our start 31 years ago as a service to the courts, and we are still that. So you had asked earlier where our cases come from. About half our cases are still somehow court annexed or court connected. We have mediators who sit in the jury boxes in civil court and small claims court, and will mediate right there on the spot if the judge or court staff will refer them. We're increasingly growing into what I'm seeing is a vital community resource as well. So more and more cases are coming from the community. We're increasingly engaged in some of these multi-party community-wide cases, which harkens back to the work that I did in Eastern Central Europe, and is an example of how what we're doing here has been really influenced by my work abroad. It's kind of an international development in reverse kind of model.
Sure.
And I see more and more of that as the future of where we're going. I think an area that's tremendously exciting to me is the work that we're doing around training mediators. You know, there's such a demand for the skill sets, and as any convert to this field will say, we think that everyone should be trained in mediation.
Of course.
So doing that and finding new and exciting ways to impart the information by using art and theater and music and all of these kinds of methodologies, that's exciting for me as well.
Wonderful. And you talk about, the field growing in general, and I know that you teach as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a bit about the program that you teach in.
Well, I teach at the New York University Center for Global Affairs, mm-hmm. So it's a Master's of Science in International Relations. And I teach a couple of courses there. One course, which I taught with Professor Alan Gross, who I know you know,
yes.
It's called Mediation Skills for Global Affairs. It's essentially the core of it is a basic mediation training, but all of the role plays are based on international cases that Alan or I have worked on. And we also have a special apprenticeship that takes place here at the New York Peace Institute that's done in cooperation with that Center for Global Affairs. So there's very much a partnership between NYU and New York Peace Institute. Mm-hmm. And I teach another course there called How to Build Your Own NGO, or Non-Governmental Organization, or Nonprofit. And the courses that I teach are basically...
your life.
It's great to be learning, teaching, and doing at the same time.
Yeah.
I feel just really lucky to be doing that. And my goal at NYU was to offer the courses that I wish had been available when I was in graduate school. So I was lucky to have just a great graduate school education, but I really didn't feel I learned some of the practical things that I needed in the workforce. So how to manage people, how to deal with conflict, how to deal with budgets, how to get the word out. So I crafted a course on how to develop your own nonprofit organization that would teach all of these different things. And as I submitted that syllabus, it's exactly when New York Peace Institute was ready to be spun off. So I was teaching it and living it
at the same
time.
That's
yeah.
So awesome. Wow.
Yeah, it was incredible. And I'm very proud to say that I've stolen some of my best ideas from my students.
That's great. Do they know about this? Are they, getting credit?
I'd be very proud to tell them. And if they listen to this, they'll surely know. The
absolutely.
Jig is up, right?
You're teaching then, in areas where people are not necessarily going to run out and hang out a shingle and become mediators or mediate at mediation centers, but using the skills of mediation to inform how they do their work and develop the programs that they might go out and develop in areas that are perhaps tangential. But, I guess it's about an approach to communicating and an approach to
mm-hmm.
managing conflict and resolving disputes. What kind of feedback do you get from your students about having that particular, course or, there's a word I'm trying to think of, and it just kind of slipped out of my mind. But learning that skill set in a way that's sort of tangential to what they're actually doing in grad school.
One of the most gratifying things about teaching what we teach is that you can take this stuff and use it at home.
Yeah.
So it's so gratifying when students will say, this has really helped prepare me for a career in international diplomacy. And by the way, it's also helped my marriage.
No.
My home life, for my family like that.
Yeah.
I am delighted to hear that.
Sure.
That actually it resonates on so many different levels. And while it's true that people take both the courses at NYU and our training here at New York Peace Institute for all kinds of reasons. Some of them do want to hang out that shingle. And I'll tell you, nothing makes me happier than when someone sets up their own mediation practice and succeeds,
mm-hmm.
and is doing it in a way that comports with our standards of quality and our values.
Right.
One of our goals here is to really build mediation as a profession. So I think the more successful people working in our field and getting paid for it, the better. And if we can be a small part of that happening, I'm delighted. And of course, many people take these courses because they want to handle conflict differently in their lives, which is also absolutely wonderful.
Well, in that vein, as we're coming down to the last couple of minutes of the show, how can a person then reach the New York Peace Institute? I know that you might call 311, which is really convenient. Just call 311 and perhaps ask for it. But what other ways can folks use to reach out to the Institute?
Great. Well, certainly through our website, which again is nypeace.org.
Yes.
So nypeace.org. There's tremendous amounts of information about our services, our training. You can give us a call. So, and that's 212-577-1740. And whether you're involved in a dispute, whether you know someone who is, whether you just want to connect with us, whether you want to become a peace builder yourself here in New York City, give us a call, reach out to it. We're all over the place in terms of social networks. So we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Google+. We're really trying to use social media as best we can to get the word out.
Right. Right. Well, we've just gotten our 90-second warning, and I've had a delightful time talking with you about something that, of course, is a passion of mine, but hearing your story of how you got into mediation and your fantastic experience that you've had abroad has been such a wonderful experience for me. Thank you so much for coming on and joining us.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Good. Awesome. Well, we're coming down to the end of the show. I hope that you enjoyed the conversation and that you'll come back and listen again to our next broadcast. And I will, of course, put out notices about what that is and when that is and who the next show is. You can come to the website for the show, blogtalkradio.com/batabile. That's my first name, and it's B-A-T-H-A-B-I-L-E. And, of course, that's perhaps where you're listening right now. Join in by subscribing to the show so that you get reminders on a regular basis as well, so that you'll never miss a show. And you can actually subscribe to the show via iTunes so that it gets automatically downloaded to your MP3 player, and you can take the show and listen to it whenever you like. Have a wonderful week, and we will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye, everyone.